This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. And when we say Washington, we mean Washington, D.C. It's not just the seat of our democracy. It's a city where more than 700,000 people live. And for the last 2 weeks, it's been one big security zone.
Since the insurrection, it's been hard to go outside, hard to know where you can go and be safe. It was unnerving to see the delay in the response to the attacks on the Capitol, and I think that's shaken a large part of the D.C. population. I hope we get to a point of safety soon.
What does a point of safety look like for the district? And when an insurrection happens, who's left to clean up the mess, figuratively and literally? Let's get into it with our guests. Rachel Curzius is a senior editor for DCist. It's a local news website owned by WAMU, our parent station. Rachel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Reverend William H. Lamar IV. He's the pastor of Metropolitan African Methodist Episcopal Church, located in downtown D.C., five blocks away from the White House. Pastor Lamar, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Jen.
So, Rachel, police arrested three people at security checkpoints this weekend. What do we know about those arrests?
As far as what we currently know, all three of them were slightly different from one another. The most recent was on Saturday morning, a woman arrested after claiming she was both law enforcement and, quote, part of the presidential cabinet, and she was arrested for fleeing the police. The other two arrests both had to do with men who had guns on them in their cars. The first arrest was the one that seemed at first most alarming. It was a man who was arrested on Friday evening. He was from Virginia. He had a loaded handgun as well as a slew of different kinds of ammunition. And he was arrested for attempting to gain access using unauthorized credentials. And police reports indicated that he had all sorts of pro-gun decals on his truck. He ended up saying that he got lost in D.C. He was a security contractor trying to actually help secure the city. But I think the fact that there was so much alarm over the facts in this arrest just speak to the high degree of anxiety that D.C. residents are feeling and that folks more broadly are feeling when they're looking at what's happening in D.C.
Pastor Lamar, Inauguration Week usually looks and sounds very different for the Washington region. How is local D.C. feeling this week as things get going?
Well, I think there is amongst our parishioners a feeling of living in a militarized zone, and we are clear as to why that is the case. I mean, the insurrection was really riveting. It really rocked the city. Our congregation felt it in a different way because, of course, a couple of weeks earlier, our property had been vandalized by persons who share that white supremacist ideology and that bent toward violence. And so there are two things that I think that we're holding in tension, Jen. One is that we want our property to be protected. More so than that, we want the lives of citizens in the district to be protected. And those things we desire, but what we also would like to see is fair treatment from all when it comes to law enforcement. So there's so many things that go through my mind as you look at, remember the images from last week, and we think about what it might have looked like if those persons were black, were brown, were natives. And so there are mixed feelings, but we definitely want people to be safe and protected.
Now, you're referring to an incident back in December when the Black Lives Matter sign hanging outside your church was destroyed by a group attending a pro-Trump rally. How did you discover what happened, and how did you talk to your congregation about it?
It's a fascinating story, Jen. So we, like many congregations of all faiths, are now gathering virtually. So it was Sunday morning. We gather at 9:30 virtually. About 9:15, I started to get text messages from colleagues in the pastoral ministry, and one was apologizing and offering her support, Pastor Karen Brown. And I had no idea what had happened. So she sent to me a video that some of the persons who perpetrated the crime had recorded and placed on their Twitter feed. And so I saw that 10 minutes before we were going to go live. And so really, I felt deeply violated. deeply violated. And the violation was not just a contemporary violation, but I name it as an ancestral violation. People trying to wipe our existence away. Their very presence, what they said, what they did, is resonant with a strain of American settler colonialism and white supremacy that begins at the shore at 1619 and carries all the way up to birtherism and beyond. And after feeling the violation, the next feeling I had, Jen, and this is interesting, was a feeling of joy. Mm. Not joy that they had done what they had done, but joy that we were now called into the same struggle. It was our time not to wince, not to complain, but our time to mobilize, organize, and to continue to fight this spirit that wants to keep true democracy from ever existing. I mean, while I lament what happened at the Capitol, some of the most fundamentally anti-democratic things in this nation happened at the Capitol. The Senate is fundamentally anti-democratic. The Electoral College is fundamentally anti-democratic. And many of the persons who serve come from states that are innovating new ways to suppress votes. And so there is so much. One of the things that deeply troubles me is when our leaders say, this is not who we are. This is exactly who we are. Well, the Tulsa riots. And we got to do more. We've got to do more than say this is not who we are. We got to have the real conversations that will root out this historical reality of using violence for political ends.
Well, your church is about five blocks away from the White House. Does that take on more significance in this moment?
Oh, yeah. So if you were to read the historical documents from the ancestors who placed us there, Daniel Alexander Payne was one who actually had conversations with Abraham Lincoln, and his prayer helped to convince Lincoln to emancipate enslaved persons in the district. But they wanted the church five blocks away from the White House. And in my language, we serve as a bulwark against the worst impulses of American imperialism and white supremacy. And beyond that, we serve as a welcome place for all human beings who are committed to human flourishing. The thing is, I want even those who perpetrated violence against us to flourish as human beings. I have a vision of complete inclusion of all human beings in this project. And that is not a vision that they share. And the way that we get out of that is to stop patting ourselves on the back for something we've never been. Let's create that thing in this space.
When we look across D.C., Rachel, what kinds of security measures are we seeing?
We're seeing all measure of road closures, the closure of various metro stations, as well as soon to be the closure of bridges coming in and out of D.C. And so that ranges from being inconvenient for people to certainly being confusing, and especially because they've been rolled out from different kinds of security agencies. So it's been difficult to have one clearinghouse of information for what is happening when. Certainly there will be 25,000 National Guard troops, as well as a number of different federal law enforcement agencies. And I just want to talk a little about what it means, for example, when bridges close. For instance, it'll mean in Ward 7 and 8, which already have fewer grocery stores than the rest of D.C. and fewer access to resources, that their main way of getting into downtown D.C. and accessing other grocery stores is going to be foreclosed on them for a couple of days. And so it also means that people in Capitol Hill, and I want your listeners to know here that Capitol Hill isn't just a metonym for Congress. D.C. residents know it is a neighborhood where people live and work. There are schools and businesses that people in Capitol Hill need to show identification in order to even get back into their neighborhood. And so all of these things make it really difficult for folks to go about their everyday life in the physical landscape, which isn't to say anything about, I think, the emotional anxiety and turmoil that people are feeling so on edge about what has happened, what could happen. We don't have any indication currently that any sort of crowds of extremists, of far-right extremists, are going to gather in D.C. in the same levels we saw on January 6th, but that doesn't mean that there aren't going to be individual actors looking to cause harm in D.C. And when they see that the downtown core is so locked down, they may wander into neighborhoods. And I think that that has people really on guard. I mean, the downtown has what's called a red zone and a green zone, words that people don't normally ascribe to security measures in their neighborhoods and in their city.
Pastor, we have just about 30 seconds here, but what security measures has your church put in place, both leading into pro-Trump protests and heading into the inauguration this week?
Well, Jim, we're appreciative of the support of our mayor and council persons to make sure that the Metropolitan Police Department is nearby, and we also have our own measures. We're very clear. We've been where we are for almost 200 years. We're not going anywhere, and we're going to make sure that we protect the gift that our ancestors have bequeathed to us.
That's the Reverend William H. Lamar IV. He's the pastor of the Metropolitan African Methodist Episcopal Church in Washington. Pastor Lamar, thank you.
Thank you, Jen.
And Rachel Kurzius, senior editor at DCist, is staying with us. And we're hearing from you. Tom tweeted about how it feels to live in D.C. right now. He says, the anxiety associated with often wondering, what's the next shoe to drop? Hashtag too many fences. And Josh tweeted, a lot of us are jumpy. When all the lights and devices turned off at an instant in our house late last night, the first thing I thought of was an inauguration-related attack. Several neighbors report they had the same reaction. It was probably just a local outage. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. January 6th was a scary day for the people who go to work at the Capitol building. This includes members of Congress and their staff, but also security personnel, custodians, and kitchen workers whose lives were just as much at risk. Cook Ricky Toon has worked at the U.S. Capitol since 1985. He was home that day, but he heard from many of his colleagues on the Hill. 1A producer Avery Kleinman spoke to him on Friday, and she began by asking him what the day of the insurrection was like.
What I experienced at home was seeing the fear and listening to my coworkers, because, like, I'm the head shop steward up there, you know, and, like, my phone was just ringing off, like, the bat.
What were you hearing from your coworkers that day?
The, like, ones that were in, like, the Capitol, like this lady named Miss Cynthia, like, she told me the cafeteria is on B, and right above us is the first floor. And, like, she said that, like, they could literally hear the people all up in, like, the top of, like, the building, you know, like, making all this ruckus and making all, like, this noise and stuff. And, like, normally you can't even hear anybody upstairs, you know.
Did the people who were there, did they feel like their safety was a priority to law enforcement as much so as the members of Congress and their staff?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I mean, you know, for like that moment when like it first happened, everybody is nervous. But after like they get us in like the location where like, they want us at, everybody is just, you know, like talking like regular. Like they were just nervous. They were just nervous, but like they felt comfortable being in this secluded spot.
Was anyone given any days off in the aftermath of what they experienced?
The like next day, a couple of them called me and like told me that like, they wasn't going to work. Like they was expected to like come to work, but they didn't show up. Like they called out, and I don't think that like, the company gave them any grief about it.
When did you go? When did you go back in?
I went back Monday, and I've been to work all week.
How did you feel going back in? Did you feel safe?
No, I didn't. I didn't, but I knew that, like, I had to, you know. I'm not going to say for fear for, like, really, like, losing my job, but I'm like the head shop steward, and I try to, like, set a good example for all of the other people. I didn't feel safe until, like, I got there. When, like, I got there and, like, I seen the military out there, you know, I thought it was going to be like it normally is because of, like, always park at the bottom of the Capitol. And just that walk going up that hill, you know, to me, I know that I guess a historic site and all like that, but there's no lighting. And I just felt good when I got to the parking lot and I started walking and I seen all these military people out there. The little spotlights were on and I felt a little relieved, but I was still looking around me because like there were still a lot of dark spots around that big place. So I was just being cautious.
What other preparations are in place ahead of the inauguration?
Like they got the military everywhere. And I did notice the day when I came out that even though that they put them tall fences up, they got barbed wire going all the way down the street, all the way as far as like you can see it. And that's a relief too, you know. I mean, when like you see a like gun on like somebody, that make you think, hey, I ain't going that route. I mean, in a way, it makes you kind of nervous, but, you know, I just feel relaxed.
Is there anything your employer can do moving forward to improve your working conditions, to make you feel more safe, considering that we've seen that you are at risk by going to your job every day?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, like, put some police out there on like, the street just so that like, we can at least, like, see a policeman. I mean, like, they got the police on, like, the, like, checkpoints whether you drive in, whether they're, like, not at the bottom of the hill or not at the parking lots whether you go at, you know, or else just put some better lighting. I think that that would make a lot of people feel comfortable.
What does it mean to you to work at the U.S. Capitol where lawmakers decide the law of the land? Do you feel the importance of the place?
Oh, yeah. My family from the Carolinas, and, you know, it just feels good when you go to a family reunion and everybody say, oh, like, there he is. There's the old chef up there, like, you know, like, cooking for, like, this congressman, cooking for, like, that congressman. You know, like, it just makes me feel big time. I got all types of pictures in, like, my house of, like, me and, like, president. This president, that president, this president, this vice president. I feel honored. I mean, really, I do. I'm the one, like their mother, who's giving them nourishment in like the morning for like lunch. And if I have to work late, you know, like dinner. I mean, you know, it's because of me. I'm the one that's giving them nourishments. Like they eat my breakfast. I really feel good about it.
That was U.S. Capitol cook Ricky Toon talking to 1A producer Avery Kleinman. We're talking about what life is like right now for local Washington. Mark tweeted us, life in D.C. has been very, very tense. All the anger over what we've had to endure over the last 4 years being boiled down to its insane essence. And Connor commented on Facebook, the National Guard are everywhere and it looks like a police state. Law and order, yes, but the kind heavily imposed from above. And with the semi-enforced social distancing, it looks like something post-apocalyptic. Fortunately, if you get into some outlying, more residential neighborhoods of D.C., things still look merely as they did before the transition. But most Biden-Harris signs I've seen up throughout last year have now been removed, likely for fear of being targeted. Still with us is Rachel Curzius, senior editor of the local D.C. news outlet, DCist. And let's bring another voice into the conversation. Robert White is a Democrat on the D.C. Council. Councilmember White, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Jen. Thanks for having me.
What is the city of D.C. doing to keep the people who live and work here safe right now?
We are trying to encourage residents, just like folks from out of town, to really stay away from the downtown part of the city. We have police on patrol around the city. And we are, on a local level, really trying to wrap our heads around what's happening in this city as much as everybody else is, because as you know, as many people know, the District of Columbia government does not have control over the D.C. Guard or the inauguration security. And so it's we are really playing a game of trying to make sure we understand what security measures are being taken and that we can convey all the information we need to residents. But it's a difficult and confusing time for everyone.
Well, we spoke to Pastor William H. Lamar IV of the Metropolitan AME Church, and he shared concern that with the area around the inauguration, around the Capitol being blocked off, that maybe some potentially violent activity could spill over into the residential parts of D.C. How much of a concern is that for you?
That's absolutely a concern for me and for many residents. We know that there are not, to our knowledge, any organized attacks being planned, but that doesn't preclude small groups or individual people from really carrying out dangerous activities. And because they cannot get close to the Capitol, perhaps doing it in our neighborhoods. And what we saw surrounding the riot and the insurrection on January 6th is many of these folks who came to town causing issues, danger, fear in our neighborhoods. And so this is something that we've had to experience. It's something that residents have had to experience, even folks who don't live anywhere near the Capitol or the National Mall.
What security warnings have the D.C. Council been briefed on?
We've had briefings with our local law enforcement who are in very close touch with federal law enforcement officials. And so at least as of Friday, we were briefed on the various security threats and security measures. So we have a pretty solid idea of what to expect. But what's not lost on us and shouldn't be lost on anyone is that what we worry about is the unexpected, the things that are not bubbling up online. Unfortunately, this type of homegrown radicalism and terrorism has really found a breeding ground online, right in front of people's faces. And after it really culminated on the attack with the attack on the Capitol, they have really retreated to the recesses of the internet. So we are really having to continue to track through our law enforcement, through law enforcement partners, what's going on in parts of the internet that, frankly, seems law enforcement wasn't paying particularly close attention to before.
Well, we should note the Capitol grounds appear to be on lockdown. This is according to NBC and CBS News. NBC4 reports a security alert has gone out. It reads, due to an external security threat, no entry or exit is permitted at this time. You may move throughout the buildings, but stay away from exterior windows or doors. If you are outside, seek cover. And we'll bring you more information as we get it. We got this message from Vivian, and she told us what she's noticed around D.C.
One main thing is there's a lot more cops everywhere. There's a lot more blue lights everywhere. Even though that does make me feel a bit more safer, cops are scary at the end of the day. And then the main thing is working, because I'm in school full time. I'm not able to work. So I DoorDash, I deliver food, which I wasn't able to do for at least 3 days following the 6th. And I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to do it in the next 1 or 2 weeks with everything that's coming up.
We also got this tweet from Fair, who says, you really should point out that most of the city is not locked down or being patrolled by military. The Monumental Core is, and that is terrible. But elsewhere, we are leading our normal, albeit COVID normal, lives. Rachel, tell us more about what the insurrection and the upcoming inauguration means for Washingtonians trying to work and make ends meet, whether they live closer to the Capitol or outside of it.
Well, just like we saw, the election wasn't one day. It kind of ended up lasting weeks and months. We're seeing the same thing with the inauguration, is that basically since the violent insurrection, D.C. has been under a state of emergency. That's on top of the state of emergency that residents have been under due to the COVID-19 pandemic since late March. And a state of emergency is basically a bureaucratic designation that allows Mayor Bowser to better corral resources. But I think it also speaks a lot to the state of mind that a lot of Washingtonians are feeling right now. And there's a divide in some senses. I spoke with one woman who lives in Penn Quarter, which is an area in downtown D.C., which is, quote, in the red zone. And she says, you know, I feel such resentment that I'm the one being told to stay in my house as if I did something wrong here, when really we're being forced to stay inside due to all of these scary, scary threats. And, you know, that's something we've heard a lot as residents. January 6th marked the third pro-Trump kind of false claim about the election rally in D.C. And each time, residents were told for their own safety to basically stay away, see downtown. And residents, for the most part in D.C., more than 90% of them voted for Joe Biden. So the people who were coming to march didn't, on the whole, reflect their values, but really had taken over so much of the city already. And so I think what we saw on January 6th was the most recent and certainly the most violent and the most scary, but it's viewed in this larger context. And again, not just having to do with these violent rallies, but also a city that for a year, like the rest of the country and world, has been living under a pandemic. So I think that people have already been feeling like they're very much stretched to the limit. And this has increased that. I think that some people who have the means and ability to do so have decided to leave town for a couple of days. But for many people, that's not an option. And the question of how are essential workers dealing with this, when I spoke to researchers who study extremism and said, you know, essential workers who still have to go to work, what should they be doing? And really the only answer that they had was they should be staying vigilant. They should be kind of looking around and making sure that they, you know, that they're in safe places. And if you see something, say something. But they remain vulnerable to the violence in the same way that they've remained the most vulnerable to the pandemic. So this is all part of kind of a larger context here.
Well, Councilmember White, we know Airbnb canceled all D.C. reservations during inauguration week. Many local restaurants shut down, too. What is the city able to do to help local businesses and workers through this time, a time when ordinarily there'd be a lot of income coming into their businesses?
I wish we had the answer right now. We, like every other jurisdiction in the country, have already been doing our best with local funds to try to figure out how to support and buttress local businesses during a time that has been devastating for so many of our small businesses because of the coronavirus pandemic. And we've developed many solutions because of our fiscal strength heading into the pandemic that were stronger than what many other jurisdictions could do to support their businesses. But we are still trying to figure out how do we help our Airbnb hosts and other businesses that are impacted by this shutdown as a result of the threats on the inauguration, threats on the Capitol. And it's something that we're going to have to continue to work through because our residents don't deserve to be impacted by threats from outside folks the way that they have been. Life has been disrupted just in incredible ways, from individuals to the impacts on businesses. And, you know, this is new territory for us. So we are absolutely trying to figure it out as we go.
Well, I want to listen to a little bit of what District Mayor Muriel Bowser said the day after the insurrection.
I am heartened that our police and guards people were able to get control of the building and that our lawmakers went back into that building to vote. I'm upset that 706,000 residents of the District of Columbia did not have a single vote in that Congress yesterday, despite the fact that our people were putting their lives on the line to protect our democracy.
Very briefly, Council Member, do you see that event as an argument for D.C. statehood?
This is not a new argument. I just hope that more people realize it as it happens in front of their face. In every war that this nation has fought, D.C. residents have fought and died in wars that they have no vote in their ability to enter. So this is just a continuation of the difficulty and saga that D.C. residents face not having statehood.
We're talking to D.C. Council Member Robert White and Rachel Curzius of the local news outlet DCS. We're also hearing from you. Stephen in the D.C. suburb of Reston, Virginia, emailed us saying, while I was an intern at a congressional office in the early 80s, I walked one warm summer's evening up the Capitol steps through the rotunda without any official identification and out the west portico to the mall where the sun was setting orange and purple and the National Symphony Orchestra was playing Rhapsody in Blue. Pennsylvania Avenue streetlights coming on and beat to the music. That's a memory I'll have to hold on to. It seems doubtful it could be repeated soon, if ever. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and our guests in a moment. And we're talking about how the people living and working in Washington, D.C., the bus drivers, baristas, and bartenders are feeling the impact of both the insurrection and the upcoming inauguration. Here's a message from Stacey Price, who launched the site Love Letter to D.C. last week, where residents can submit notes to their city.
It's important not only for Washingtonians to feel like we're in this together, but be reminded of why we choose to live here. When there are troops on your streets and helicopters in the air, and you're making ongoing decisions of how to ensure your safety, it's pretty easy to lose focus. I want the people on the outside to know that D.C. is a real place filled with real people, diverse, colorful, heartful people who choose this as their home.
Thanks for your message, Stacey. Our guests are two more people who have chosen D.C. as their home, at-large council member and Democrat Robert White and DCS senior editor Rachel Curzius. And joining us now is John Boardman. He's the executive secretary. Pardon me. He's the executive security treasurer of Unite Here Local 25, which represents the Washington region's hotel workers. Hi, John. Welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
So about 25,000 members of the National Guard have arrived in D.C. to secure the city ahead of this week's inauguration. Many of them are staying at D.C. hotels. Now, the Associated Press reported on Sunday that the FBI was vetting all Guard troops after intelligence suggested some could be planning an attack on the inauguration. How secure are the hotels themselves?
We'd like to think that they're, the hotels where the security forces are being housed are, in fact, very secure, and they are sprinkled all over town and are, in fact, in most of the hotels we represent.
You've called on hotels in the D.C. region that are not housing hosting security forces to close. Why?
We base that decision on the experiences of our members during the insurrection last week, where they were confronted with white supremacists and the actions of those white supremacists, which included threatening interactions, threat of physical violence, public health situations. If you were in any of those lobbies during that period, it was like a super spreader event with no one wearing masks and cheek by jowl.
What would you say to someone who argues that their political leanings shouldn't prevent them from booking a hotel room?
Well, I think that applies to people who are here to protest peacefully, and that is not what we saw last week. I think every image that you see from the insurrection demonstrates that people were not here for peaceful protests. And that activity extended back into the places they were staying after they finished assaulting the Capitol.
Now, the inauguration is usually a very profitable time for D.C.'s hospitality business, but not this year. Talk about that and what the loss means for local hotel workers.
You're absolutely correct. This time of year, which is traditionally slow in Washington, but every 4 years we have the honor of hosting this national event. And it is a time when our members and all people in the hospitality industry in the city can expect to be taking care of a lot of people from out of town as they come to the nation's capital. Our members, for example, in the hotels they work at, get double time on inauguration day. So this is a huge hit to their income, both from a loss of the inability to work, but also from a loss of showing people what the city is like and encouraging them to come not only now, but at other times.
How are you thinking about what happened after inauguration day and what efforts the union and the hotel administration can put forth to make sure workers are safe and protected?
Well, I think you've just noted one of the main things that we think is important, and that's a recognition that there are, in fact, going to be situations that are just patently unsafe. But it's also a recognition, the other part of our request was, in addition to closure if you don't have security forces, is that individual workers can make a decision about whether it's safe for them to report to work. being at work is not the only issue. Getting to and from work becomes a critical part of whether you feel safe and comfortable. So we've arranged with our properties that if a worker does not feel safe and comfortable, they can phone in and decline to come to work.
That's John Boardman. He's the executive secretary treasurer of Unite Here Local 25. That's the union representing the Washington region's hotel workers. John, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And still with us is D.C. Council member Robert White and DC's senior editor Rachel Curzius. We got this email from Henry who says, I disagree with the comment made earlier that most of D.C. neighborhoods are going about their business. The George Washington University Medical Practice shut down our outpatient practice on Tuesday for safety concerns. This included our COVID testing facility. This impacts patients throughout the region. The hospital is rescheduling surgeries for the week. Our emergency department is under mass casualty preparation as it was 2 weeks ago. Research personnel have been asked not to come to campus until after the inauguration. You know, Rachel, this highlights the fact that D.C., I mean, this is having larger implications. D.C.'s economy was struggling like the rest of the country before this. But, I mean, how far does the impact of last week's insurrection and the security response reach?
I think part of the question that folks have is this question of, quote, when things go back to normal begs this broader question of what is normal? Are we talking about normal as of the end of December, normal as of 2018? And I read an interview in Washingtonian with a restaurateur who said the fact that January business is going to be so bad, maybe the silver lining is that it means it can only get better from here. And I should also note that when it comes to restaurants in D.C., currently the ban on indoor dining is still in effect because in addition to all of these security concerns, we are facing a huge surge in COVID-19 cases. And so this question of how long we're going to feel this impact, I think is one that continues to reverberate. We just don't know the answer to that question. There's also the question of the physical landscape. I think part of what was so marvelous about D.C., and you had someone mentioning this before, is the fact that the Capitol has been somewhat open in the past, that all of these are monuments to democracy that allow the public to enter. And when things do shut down and when there is security apparatuses involved and checkpoints, those don't always go away just because the threat level goes down or just because the state of emergency ends. So the question of what will DC look like? How will residents get to interact with the physical environment as well as one another when all of this, when the National Guard troops leave, when the state of emergency ends? I think we don't know that right now. I mean, for example, the DC's delegate had to fight for years for Washingtonians to have the opportunity to sled on Capitol Hill. And the question is, will that kind of access to green spaces and to parts of the city go away due to ongoing fears about violence and armed protests?
And a quick correction here. I said the insurrection was last week. It was actually the week before last. We got this email from Mara who says, how are the rest of the inhabitants of the mall in D.C., the museums who line the perimeter, faring in this upheaval? They have a lot of priceless artifacts of art, history, and science, especially the Museum of American History. Rachel, do we know if there are any special precautions being taken?
Well, all of those museums are in the part of D.C. that is under intense lockdown right now. So those are protected as much as any of those other buildings are right now. I can't speak to whether there are specific protections for the archives or any of those other buildings.
Well, we're hearing from lots of you in the D.C. region. Mike tweets, I'm trying to keep a glass half full with all this craziness going on in the city I live in and love. It's a great time to get on your bike and ride around. No traffic. Laura tweeted, the Capitol is my neighbor down the street. I walk past her every day. The scene yesterday as we stood with our neighbors as close as we could get was very sad. We were just checking in on our buddy. And W. Melton tweeted, some rally attendees stayed at B&Bs in my East of the River neighborhood, and that was disconcerting. Given B&B companies are disallowing rentals, I'm a little more at ease about neighborhood attacks. Councilmember White, on Friday, Mayor Muriel Bowser was asked if these security measures will go away after the inauguration, and she responded that D.C. is looking at, quote, a new normal. What's your understanding of what that new normal might look like?
Well, we don't know yet. We know that there will be increased security, increased alert going forward, because what we are hearing from terrorism and extremist experts is that they don't believe that the insurrection that we saw on January 6th and frankly some of the very violent protests in the weeks leading up to that are the last of these. And frankly, we may be entering into an era where we are seeing more of these violent protests or more attacks. And there will be increased caution and security in state houses, at state houses across the country, with threats becoming known to you know, plans for violence at those state houses. So the changes following the inauguration will not be felt exclusively in D.C. We will feel them more than most. We will see them more than most. But our entire country is really wading into an era that I think is going to be difficult, because we're going to see increased security for at least some time.
A quick update here. Earlier, we told you the Capitol had been placed on lockdown. We have a bit of an update there. D.C. Fire now says the incident near the Capitol involved a small fire at a tent that has now been put out. It's not being considered a security threat. Council member, how do you split the difference between keeping residents secure and not over-policing the district? Because for some residents, seeing a ton of police cars in their neighborhood will not necessarily make them feel safer.
Yeah, that's something we have to take very seriously. So many, especially as an African-American in the Black community, we see the presence of increased police and increased military in a different way often than our white neighbors. And certainly just having more law enforcement, be it military or police, don't necessarily make you safer. So what we have to do is continue to listen to our residents and to remember that the District of Columbia, while the seat of the federal government, is the home to over 700,000 people who pay taxes, who are American citizens, and who have every right to live their lives with every comfort and convenience that we all deserve. And we can't lose sight of that. We can't just react to becoming a military state. Everything we do has to be thoughtful. And so we all have to resist this temptation to just jump on board with whatever security recommendation is made. We can do that for a short time, but anything longer than a really small, finite period of time, we have to be very deliberate about and always think about the impacts on civil liberty and the impacts on communities of color specifically.
And more broadly, with the incoming Biden administration, what would you like to see from this administration to respond to this threat of white nationalist extremism that national security experts have been warning about for some time?
I need the Biden administration to do the very hard work of addressing and untangling the double standard of justice that allowed for this attack on the Capitol. We have for so long seen race-based threat assessment. So too often law enforcement will shoot first at people of color, but give the benefit of the doubt to white people. And it is this kind of line of thinking and nexus between race and security assessments that allowed our federal law enforcement officers to really not take the threat on the Capitol as seriously as they should have. And it has exposed a deep vulnerability in the country. So now the impacts of something that's been happening for generations is not just felt by communities of color, but felt by everyone in the sense of a homeland security threat. And they have to wade through that difficult conversation and practice of racial bias. Otherwise, we do not have a path out of this.
Rachel, we got this tweet from AA who says, is it possible to walk to the MLK Memorial today? Of course, today is Martin Luther King Day. It's a day of service, but some people might want to go to that memorial. Is that possible?
You know, I'm not sure. I've seen some photos of people at or near the memorial. Certainly there is a lot of military and National Guard around, but I'm not sure about the current access to that memorial, and I know that things are shifting on a pretty frequent basis. I will note that the traditional annual Martin Luther King Day parade that typically happens in D.C. is now happening virtually, and that's both a response to the pandemic as well as to these additional security threats that the D.C. government is seeing.
That's Rachel Kurzius. She's the senior editor for DCist, a local news outlet owned by WAMU. Also with us, Robert White. He's a Democrat on the D.C. Council. Rachel, Robert, thanks for your time. Remember, you can follow the show on Instagram at The 1A Show. Today's producer was Avery Kleinman. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.